Oh, wow. Becoming a hurricane.
John, no. The answer is no, but it's at NIAAA.
Okay, thank you.
All right. That's one of the questions I have for them today. Is that Michael on the phone? Who's in 202?
Isn't that New York?
No, it's Washington, D.C.
Ed, how are you? It's Tom.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
I'm doing well.
And there's Miguel DeCampo back from his trip to Alaska.
Yeah. Hi.
You had a good time, huh?
Amazing time. Yeah. Quite a place.
It is quite a place.
Quite a place. Yeah. If you want, later we can talk about these meetings that I had.
Well, I want to talk about your the cool animals you saw and you went fishing. Did you go fishing or anything?
We went fishing. Yeah, we got even the halibut shipped. It was almost too easy, you know. You just throw. I mean, they're explaining what you should feel at the bottom, and I was pulling out some fish already, and it was like 35 pounds. I mean, I don't know. That ocean just has too much fish. So yeah, we fished, we river rafted, and we had a blast. It's beautiful, beautiful.
Oh, I just
very warm. I was surprised.
Oh, I just opened up and now I see everybody. I was looking only at six pictures and now I see that everybody's showing up. So 10 o'clock, so let me just go quick through here and I can do the roll call this just by looking at who's here. No, let me, I can't. Claire's there, Joanne's there, Jeff's there, Johan and Scott.
Scott at least is here.
Tatiana. Mike Suddy's there. Sandra's there. The Tories are there. Tom Donaldson's there. Raj, Miguel, John Hannigan. Sarah Jo there yet?
I just saw her. There she is.
Yes, I am.
You're off screen now. There you are. Nice orange blazer. James Reynolds, Dan Savage. I saw Bill Dunty. I haven't seen you since vacation, Bill. You all recovered?
Doing well.
And Joe Wang, there he is. Olivia's there and Julie's there. Okay. So I'm missing Charnas, Christy Petrenko. There you are. Christiana. Yep.
Hi.
Scott or Johan. Oh, Scott's there. And Tatiana, I saw.
I'm here.
How are you doing, Tatiana?
Okay, I'm going to be very quiet. They're bringing a tree down right outside my house.
Oh, I had that done the other day. What a mess.
Oh, my goodness. Can't even imagine. It's a really old tree. It's huge.
I had 5 eucalyptus trees taken down. So they were not pretty trees and fire hazard. So they went. So, all right. I have one notice that Jill has requested that. Could you please take a look again at the doodle poll and see what you can do about our fall meeting? It's been really hard to find 4-hour slots that where everybody can be there. So if you can look at it again and see what you can do to help us out, we'd appreciate it. And then in the agenda that Jill sent out, she also put a few other reminders and action items, and we can come back to them after today's program. What I did today was, I know that there's some new interesting data that has come out. Olivia Weeks published a paper And then I know that there's data out of Atlanta as well. So I've asked Olivia to present today and then to follow up and have Julie present on the data that's being collected within CFAS. So if, Jill, if you want to turn over screens and do what you do, that would be a great. Now, Olivia is at Harvard and works in the Gossage lab, or has worked there. I'm not quite sure your current position, but...
Neither am I, to be honest.
But she has done some great work, and she gets rave reviews by some people that I know. So we're happy to have you here today, and welcome to the CFAS monthly conference call.
Thank you very much. Hopefully everyone can hear me, and if not, shoot me a message. Today I'm going to be talking about my recently published work and tell you about some things we're following up on, and that centers around metabolic abnormalities in adult patients with FASD. Some of you might know me. I recognize quite a few faces, but if not, I'll take a moment to introduce myself and my PI. My name is Olivia Weeks. I'm a postdoctoral fellow at Brigham and Women's Hospital in the Division of Genetics. I recently defended my dissertation about a month or two ago. And my PI is Wolfram Gosling. He's the chief of gastroenterology at the MGH. Our laboratory is based at Harvard Medical School. There's a white arrow pointing to our building. And as you can see, we are housed in this huge Longwood Medical Area. So there's this enormous opportunity to collaborate with a number of the clinicians and hospitals that are nearby us to try to pick out FASD patients that are coming to our clinics. So I don't have to tell you guys how important FASD is. So I'm just going to briefly tell you my project goals and then show some data. So the first thing that our lab is really interested in is trying to identify cardiometabolic health outcomes in adults that have FASD. And specifically, we're interested in whether prenatal alcohol exposure can serve as a risk factor for obesity and diabetes and cardiovascular disease. We want to do this in a patient, human patient model of FASD. Our second goal is to really confirm a causal relationship between an alcohol exposure event during embryogenesis and whatever outcome seems to be important from our FASD patient cohort. And we do this using the zebrafish model and a highly controlled environment. Oftentimes, the correlative health outcomes that come out of our epidemiological studies are extremely important, but they could sort of be correlated due to other sort of reasons. So showing causation in zebrafish, we think, or other animal models is extremely helpful. And then finally, because we have animal models, we'd like to decipher mechanisms that lead to specific cardiometabolic health events. And we're specifically focused right now on obesity and diabetes. And we do this also in the zebrafish. So speaking to our first goal, can we identify metabolic health outcomes in adults with FASD? We basically generated or identified a cohort of FASD patients using the Partners Research Patient Data Registry. So as I mentioned, we're a part of the Mass General Brigham, formerly known as Partners Healthcare, and that's a conglomerate of more than 14 different hospitals and institutions. And the RPDR allows us to search the medical records of patients that have been seen at any of these institutions. And we have IRB approval to pull their files and their full medical history to identify what has happened to them throughout their lifetime. And we've done this in collaboration with Matt Steinhauser and Puna Vizzelli. They were previously at the Brigham and Women's and the MGH respectively. They are married and have moved together to Pitt. But we are still in constant communication with them, and they are doing a lot of the statistical analyses for our cohort. So how did I identify and characterize patients in this cohort? We searched the RPDR, and I got thousands of clinic files back that were hits for FASD. And basically, I went through each clinic file by hand to pull out patients that had a confirmed FASD diagnosis. That includes patients with FAS, partial FAS, alcohol-related neurodevelopmental disorder, an alcohol-related birth defect, or fetal alcohol effects if The clinician didn't make a specific diagnosis, but is relating to the phenotype to alcohol exposure in utero. We found 103 males and 105 females with what we believe to be confirmed reliable FASD diagnosis. We then retrospectively recorded the metabolic parameters from the clinic files, paying specific attention to BMI, to height, weight, blood glucose, lipid levels, diabetes status, and also now we're working on cardiovascular disease status. And importantly, we calculated a study age for each of our patients because sometimes BMI and height measurements were taken sort of earlier in the medical history. So the patient's study age became whatever age their parameters had been taken at, because a lot of these outcomes are actually age-related. We then identified controls that were matched for age, sex, and race ethnicity. And then we performed comparative statistics on the metabolic health outcomes seen in both cohorts to see if anything is sort of enriched in FASD cohort with respect to really obesity and diabetes were the two main things. This slide demonstrates the age distribution of the patients that were included in our cohort. Females averaged an age about 30 years old, and the range was from about 18 to 77. Males, average age was around 29, and same average age range from about 18 to 77. And these two graphs just give you an idea of the distribution of patient ages from both cohorts. Each dot represents a different individual patient from the study. What did we find in our cohort? So one of the first things that stood out is that FASD patients do seem to have abnormal BMI and height measurements. The height is not unexpected. So what I'm going to show you here are just graphs of the data. Each individual dot, again, represents one patient. The blues are controls and the reds are FASDs. So with respect to body mass index, we're interested in this really because of the idea of perhaps there's an obesity risk in these patients, and BMI can be a good metric for assessing that. When we looked at males, we actually found that more males with FASD were underweight than controls. More had a BMI of less than 18.5, and males did not seem to have a strong propensity for obesity or elevated BMI. However, females that had an FASD diagnosis did have a significantly higher just overall BMI number, and also there were more females that had overweight and obesity as defined by a BMI of greater than 25. And so we saw sex-specific effect of FASD correlating with obesity in females. With respect to height, both males and females had significantly reduced absolute height measurements, and a number of the FASD patients had short stature, which again is quite expected. We also looked at other metabolic abnormalities like dyslipidemia and diabetes. With respect to high density lipoprotein, both males and females had significantly reduced HDL levels. And furthermore, patients with FASD had a tendency to have more metabolic abnormalities occurring in the same patient than the controls did. So when we combine the male and female cohorts together, FASD patients had significantly higher incidence of type 2 diabetes. In the males, this was independent of BMI, but in the females, it was dependent on the co-presence of obesity. There was also elevated triglyceride levels in FASD patients, which when taken with HDL suggests that they have a higher propensity for dyslipidemia. And also, almost 50% of FASD patients had the co-occurrence of more than one metabolic abnormality. So that means they might have overweight obesity and diabetes and dyslipidemia. And we think that's indicative of potentially an increased risk for the metabolic syndrome. Although we did not evaluate all parameters, we didn't look at blood pressure or waist measurements, so we can't really say that for sure. And so we think all this data is really interesting and promising and suggestive that maybe FASD patients do have a higher risk for cardiometabolic disease. And one thing that we're working on right now is evaluating cardiovascular disease outcomes. What we would really like to do is take these same patients from our cohorts and see whether they have a higher incidence of hypertension, heart failure, arrhythmia, coronary artery disease, myocardial infarction, or stroke. And so I've completed all the data collection for the males, and I'm working through the females. And then we'd also like to know whether congenital heart disease associates with some of these poor metabolic health outcomes in the FASD patients. And the reason that we're interested in this is because, consistent with the literature, our patients have a very high incidence of congenital defects, particularly in the heart, as well as some venous abnormalities. And so we haven't done statistical analyses yet, but we hope to know in the next 2 months whether either goal one or goal two, whether we see anything promising there. So I also mentioned too that we use zebrafish in order to try to prove causal relationships between ethanol exposure during development and poor adult health. And one of the reasons that we do this is because zebrafish do recapitulate key features of the human fetal alcohol spectrum disorder and can be raised in sort of huge population level cohorts. Probably most of you are familiar with this, but when treated with ethanol, characteristics of the, in quotations, FASD model of fish, they have short stature, cardiac defect, craniofacial malformations, eye abnormalities, among others. Importantly, zebrafish can be used as a model for cardiometabolic disease. So like humans, zebrafish do develop central obesity, and this can be measured with a lipophilic dye called Nile Red that binds to white adipose tissue in the fish. Fish develop white adipocytes by about 8 days post-fertilization near their exocrine pancreas. And this depot expands. And by adulthood, when you stay in the fish, you can see all the subcutaneous fat and all the visceral fat, and you can actually quantify it, especially after an ethanol exposure or in response to diet. And you can also take blood glucose measurements on each of the fish in order to assess type 2 diabetes incidence as well, or at least hyperglycemia. So because zebrafish can be used to model cardiometabolic disease, we launched these huge cohort studies in order to try to confirm what we were seeing in humans. And largely, we actually were able to. We did see a higher incidence of metabolic abnormalities in adult fish that had prior ethanol exposure. So how we did this is we mated fish. We obtained embryos. Embryos were treated with either 0% or up to 1% ethanol during critical periods of embryogenesis, 12 hours to 5 days. The reason we use up to 1% ethanol is that we did want to have a robust insult here with our fish, because we're looking at health outcomes months down the line, and there is a lot of variation between individuals and fish, so we really need to be able to see effects if they do exist. Fish were then removed from ethanol and raised just in clear water to late juvenile stages, and we did this in cohorts of up to 1,000 each time. Fish were then challenged with either a normal or a high-fat, high-cholesterol diet up through adulthood, and we assessed metabolic health outcomes, paying specific attention to visceral adiposity, weight, BMI, and blood glucose. And we were very consistent about how we measured this in each fish. And as I mentioned, what we found was pretty consistent with what we did see in the human FASD cohorts, although there were a few differences with respect to sex-specific effects that I can answer questions about later. But essentially, we found that fish that had embryonic alcohol exposure had an increased visceral adiposity at the beginning of our diet challenge. So these are fish stained with Nile Red, and this is their visceral fat, and it significantly increased in the EAA fish, even when we normalized to body size. This is true again after 4 weeks of high-fat, high-cholesterol diet challenge. These ethanol-exposed fish have a significantly increased visceral fat area, and again, is consistent even when we normalize to fish size. And importantly, we don't see this with normal diet treatment, so it does seem that the ethanol insult interacts with diet throughout life to determine whether an individual is going to get this obesity feature. And importantly, there's not only changes in visceral adiposity, but the embryonic alcohol-exposed fish have a sort of propensity for increased BMI gains in response to a high-fat diet. So alcohol-exposed fish that received high-fat, high-cholesterol diet, shown here in red, have significantly higher net BMI gains at week 2, 3, and 4 of our diet challenge compared to the controls in the blue dotted line, also receiving the high-fat, high-cholesterol diet. And so we sort of conclude that dietary stress is an important inciting factor for these abnormal BMI gains in the EAE adults, and perhaps even in humans that have a well-maintained diet, you might not expect to see these phenotypes and they might emerge with diet, and therefore there is potentially room to intervene and do more dietary studies to try to understand how to mitigate phenotypes if they indeed exist in the human population. And additionally, we looked at blood glucose level, and we also found that embryonic alcohol-exposed fish that were given high-fat diet had significantly increased fasting blood glucose levels, but did not with the normal diet. And so that indicates that they're also progressing more rapidly towards something akin to a type 2 diabetes phenotype. So one of the really exciting things is this diet-induced obesity phenotype that we see in our EAE fish or ethanol-exposed fish. Is that it's present during early larval stages, pretty much immediately following the ethanol insult. And you can see that here. Embryonic alcohol-exposed fish given a high-fat diet develop these very large visceral fat depots, which is shown here in magenta at 13 days post-fertilization. So they have a higher fat volume and an increase in visceral adipose cell number. And the thing that's great about this is we can actually do RNA sequencing on 13-day larvae, whole fish that have been homogenized to try to understand what transcriptional changes are happening in these fish that distinguish them from control fish. Oh, here, control fish here, fed the high-fat, high-cholesterol diet. And hopefully by doing this, we can identify transcriptional drivers of this phenotype. And so we did that. We basically took 0% ethanol or 1% ethanol-exposed siblings that had been exposed only during embryogenesis. We then removed the fish from ethanol, fed them a normal or a high-fat diet up to 13 days, and then performed RNA sequencing. There were 15 fish per replicate and 3 replicates per condition. And we asked which specific genes are dysregulated specifically in EAE fish only in the context of a high-fat, high-cholesterol diet. And a postdoc in our lab, Isaac Oderberg, did something called a cluster analysis, and he found two clusters that were extremely exciting, where genes in EAE fish, given the high-fat, high-cholesterol diet, behave differently than the controls. So here you can see in cluster 5, ethanol-exposed fish, given the high-fat diet, have a downregulation of a cluster of genes, whereas they are not downregulated in any other condition. And then in cluster 1, they're upregulated. And we think that genes in each of these clusters are sort of suspicious as being drivers for a diet-induced obesity phenotype. And so I'm not going to talk about the data in too great detail, but basically what we're doing right now is we've gone through and identified 4 or 5 transcriptional targets that we think might be driving our phenotypes. And I've just shown you an example of 3 here, AHHG1. ABCB11B and DHRS7D. These two genes here, A and B, are expressed in the liver, and DHRS7B is expressed in adipose tissue, and all of them have been flagged as potentially playing a role in human obesity or diabetes, in adipocyte development, or in fat absorption, as is in the case for ABCB11B. And so what we're doing right now is trying to determine the role of these genes in modulating this diet-induced obesity and hyperglycemia risk in FASD zebrafish. And we're using CRISPR-Cas9 mutagenesis for a number of our identified targets to try to do at least an F10 CRISPR screen for obesity to see which of these genes might be important. So in conclusion, we basically have a human cohort with FASD and known prenatal alcohol exposure, as well as a zebrafish cohort with known embryonic alcohol exposure. We've observed many organ malformations that I haven't gotten to discuss today, but in both cases, we think that these changes in organ development contribute to metabolic abnormalities in adulthood. So the humans, we saw an increase in type 2 diabetes risk, dyslipidemia, and overweight obesity, specifically in females. And then in zebrafish, we've documented elevated BMI, abdominal obesity, and fasting hyperglycemia. And next steps, as I mentioned, is to try to figure out what pathways are driving these effects. And so just to acknowledge our collaborators, so Michael Charnas has helped us enormously in conceiving our project. Matt Steinhauser and Puna Fazeli were our clinical collaborators. We've had help from a number of other people on components of the project I didn't talk about today, but this was a huge, huge effort with the help of many, many different contributing scientists. So with that, I can take any questions. And I will remove myself from sharing mode.
Well, I just want to thank you very much, and we will open it up for any questions that people might have.
May I ask one?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So as you know, in children, intrauterine growth restriction, so being small at birth, is probably the number one risk factor to develop metabolic syndrome in the future. And I just wonder how your human sample was in terms of weight at birth and whether you measure at all that in the zebrafish. I have no idea how weighable those larvae are, and whether there are studies about which genes are up and down regulated in IUGR conditions in zebrafish.
Yeah, so I'll start with the zebrafish question first. So I didn't get to talk about this today, but the ethanol-exposed zebrafish do have fetal growth restriction, which we determine by measuring the fish and also by weighing them. And they actually have delayed development of their adipose tissue, but they experience rapid catch-up growth from about days 10 to day 14. And during that time, they grow faster than the controls and expand their adipocyte compartment faster as well. So we do see the same thing that has been documented in humans. With respect to what genes might be driving that in fish, we don't know, although we've done RNA sequencing on earlier growth-restricted zebrafish and have seen a lot of pathways involved in cell proliferation, ribosome biogenesis, protein synthesis, that are down-regulated in those fish and then subsequently up-regulated during the compensatory growth. So I'm guessing that it's those processes that are changing. And with respect to the humans, for a lot of the patients, unless they were born at Boston Children's Hospital, we don't have their infant or fetal information. And so we have not collected any information on growth restriction for those people, but it would be amazing to do so.
I guess it is possible that the effect of alcohol is independent from IUGR, or maybe not, right?
Yes, I agree with you. We have no idea, to be honest.
Have you looked at insulin growth factor genes?
Sorry, go ahead.
I was just wondering if that is a possible mediator in the obesity development.
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. That did not come out of our top hits in our sequencing, and we also sequenced adult livers in the context of normal diet or high-fat diet, and also did not come out of that sequencing. So it's possible that it is playing a role, but it's just not one of our top suspects at the moment.
In your human subjects, was there any evidence of hypertension or other cardiovascular types of disease?
I do not have any statistical analyses performed yet on that. I think it is possible that they do have an increased risk for hypertension, but I still have to do the analysis. We've collected the data. And just the main thing that's standing out are the congenital heart defects. Mm-hmm. That do seem to affect the patients long-term. There are a few other things that we noticed in our cohort. I can put them up on the screen. Let's see. I can share this. These are unrelated. Can everybody see my screen?
Mm-hmm.
So there were a number of recurring themes or sort of unrelated to the things I talked about today that we're not planning on studying, but that you might be interested in. So unsurprisingly, many of the patients had epilepsy, Many females had irregular menses and sort of reproductive endocrine disorders. Defecation disorders were extremely common in males, and like in the adult males over the age of 20, I would say one of the most debilitating things that we saw, just not being able to use the bathroom regularly, having a lot of like psychological issues with it. And then other things that I think are pretty common and would be expected, but suicidality, drug overdose, LGBTQ related issues, inappropriate sexual behaviors, particularly in young women, and also homelessness. But those were the only other main things that we had sort of seen or that stood out.
Other questions? I was confused when you started, you were talking about how you looked at age. Mm-hmm. And could you just go over that one more time, since you have a very large age range and you have a lot of variability in some of the data. And you'd expect some of these things to happen as individuals got older. But so how was age controlled again, and for your body weight measures?
Yeah, so the patients have an actual age, and then we calculated a study age for the patients, which was the age that we actually used for normalizing all of our data. And the study age was defined by whatever age the person was when we took their body parameters. So whatever age they were when we collected their BMI, their weight, their height, their blood glucose level, and whatnot, because those things are age-related, and so we needed to make sure that we were normalizing back to, yeah, the age they were when we sampled them.
But that was all off of a chart review then, right?
Correct. That was off of a chart review, which is the big limitation of the study, being that it's all retrospective. We can't actually bring, we could, I could apply for approval, but we're not actually bringing the patients in ourselves on a specific date.
And just a really stupid idea, but you're giving them, they have all the risk factors for COVID.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of money out there right now for that.
Yes, I have actually been sneak peeking their COVID test results, and nothing has stood out yet, but I do agree with you that it would be a good idea.
They check several of the ticks for high risk.
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions? Olivia, thank you, and you're welcome. Joanne.
We can't hear you, Joanne.
Joanne, you're muted.
You're muted.
Sorry, I muted before because I was coughing. beautiful work, absolutely beautiful work. And your findings in adults really recapitulate the very informal survey, community survey done by the adults with FASD. That was presented at the CFAS meeting, at the FASD Vancouver meeting. And that information is now published in a chapter that's out in a book. So I'm not sure if you've seen it, but you know, there in real time that you have confirmed, or they have confirmed, very similar diseases, disorders, abnormalities, and so on. So very exciting work.
Thank you. I have not seen the chapter yet, so I have made a note to go look.
Yeah, the book is out. I can send you the reference.
Send it to Jill, and then Jill can send it to everybody.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Michael?
Well, I just want to say congratulations to Olivia on the work and on defending your thesis.
Thank you.
And to just highlight that the work that you've presented is a recapitulation of a mini CFAS model, which is having work in humans inform questions that can be asked in simple models, and having data that come back from simple models go back to ask questions in humans. And I think the database that you now have, with all of the flaws or limitations, I would say, associated with retrospective reviews and diagnoses per clinicians without a defined framework, are still extraordinarily valuable, because you have this group. Conceivably in the future, they could be brought in to look at other aspects, especially morphology and current metabolic, cardiovascular status, and so on. So it, you know, you have two very rich data sources now, your RNA sequence database to ask specific genetic questions, and you might be able to one day go into a database and look at them. The comment I wanted to make about COVID is that, you know, in Massachusetts, somewhere between 5 and 10% of people have been exposed, and that's a high enough prevalence to be able to detect differences even in just 200 people. So it is worth looking at those numbers. Not all of them will have a diagnosis in the chart, and at some point, you know, doing seroprevalence might be an option too, but that is an interesting set of questions that can be asked, and there is money out there for COVID studies.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
Might put fetal alcohol back on the map too. All right, Julie, let's turn it over to you. And I think everybody knows Julie. She's been involved in several CFAST projects. So
she's looking for the bar that allows me to share screen.
I don't know.
If you kind of hover at the bottom of the box, it'll pop up. And then it should be the green button. Like if you just kind of, if you're looking at a black box of squares right now, just kind of go to the bottom row of it and hover and it should pop up.
Toward the bottom of your screen.
Over here, so I actually have a bottom of the screen.
You should see a green share screen.
There we go. There. Now can you see?
Yep.
Okay, and you see my cursor if I move it around?
Yep.
All right, so I'm going to talk about cardiovascular health and prenatal alcohol exposure as well, and I'm going to focus on insulin, partially because I knew Olivia was presenting and because it's the biggest effect size that I have in this study and maybe even the biggest clinical significance. Let's see if I can. Okay, now you see the new slide. I'm going to skip this one because I think Olivia presented it. This is the Atlanta prospective cohort. They were recruited from 1980 to 1986. They were followed several times from infancy in the toddler period, seen again in school age, their teenage years, and young adulthood. They were recruited from the Grady Memorial Hospital that's pictured here. And this is a picture of homes that many of our subjects were recruited from a public housing project. So the study involves several different cardiovascular measures to look at the impact of PAE and cardiovascular outcome. I'm really gonna focus mostly on the first one, cardiovascular health measures such as cholesterol, blood pressure, diabetes indicators, and mostly just the diabetes indicators because of the time constraints. We are having, we are doing some pretty interesting other pieces to the study. So in addition, we're doing peripheral arterial tonometry that gives us an index of vascular occlusion by occluding blood flow and then releasing it. So then we can look at get an index of reactive hyperemia. And then nail fold capillaroscopy, where we're actually visualizing the nail bed capillaries using this device that goes on the tips of the fingers of the participants, a little bit of oil, and then we visualize it. And then we can count the density of these vascular tissue, the length of them, and the width of them. Then we're also going to do Effner's during a computerized task that elicits frustration and link that up to some of the measures. So here are, we stopped mid-March because of COVID, and so we originally going to enroll 40 different participants for this study. To date, we've been able to recruit 61. So we have 22 controls, data from 22 controls, 39 from with a history of prenatal alcohol exposure. There were not many group differences. So this is a sample that was matched, recruited from the same hospital. It's inner city, lower SES, predominantly African-American cohort. There were no differences in ages of the participants. We were getting slightly better acceptance from females when we recruited them into the study, but it's fairly equal between groups. Again, mostly African-American. I think we have one participant in the prenatal alcohol exposure group who's not African-American. Educational status was relatively comparable. So this is just below high school graduation levels, and that was pretty comparable for both groups. We also sampled adverse childhood events, and that was also comparable between both groups. Obviously, this is not a surprise. The weight was different. Those in the prenatal alcohol exposure group were significantly smaller than were the controls. The height was also different, but it wasn't statistically significant. And body mass index was also lower among our prenatal alcohol exposure group than were the controls. And the important thing here is to look at this level here. This is demarcating the body mass index relative to being overweight as opposed to obesity. But when we marked it relative to overweight, 90% of our controls in this sample are overweight. Remember, it's a inner city, lower SES, predominantly African-American sample, as compared to 56.4% of those in the prenatal alcohol exposure group. And that difference was statistically significant. We actually see that effect then impacting on their physical activity levels. So for those who had a history of prenatal alcohol exposure, they're actually showing higher levels of activity. It was only a trend in the overall mean level, but when we calculated the percentage who are getting sufficient physical activity to meet that 2000 kilocalorie per week requirement, significantly more in the PAE group were meeting that requirement than the controls were. So surprisingly, although we hear a whole lot about how prenatal alcohol exposure adversely impacts substance use, we actually found no differences in self-reported substance abuse or in lab results. So GGDP, which is an index of liver function, or marijuana use, or cocaine, or opiate, all of those did not differ by group status. The only thing that did differ was their self-report of ever having used alcohol, and those with a history of prenatal alcohol exposure reported 84% reporting using alcohol at some time in the past versus 59% of controls. And remember, again, we're in the South, so there's various religions that are sort of anti-alcohol consumption, so that our rates are probably higher here maybe than in a typical sample. So the issue, though, is we have two effects that are actually working to help benefit those with prenatal alcohol exposure, and that is they had lower levels of body mass index and lower levels of physical activity. And so we decided to use this POT, or higher levels of physical activity, and we decided to use this model, the POTF regression model, to control for body mass index. And so basically what we do is we look at the outcome of interest. We then put in the body mass index, we then look at the alcohol effect, and then an interaction between the alcohol effect and the body mass index. So relative to our diabetes indicators, we have plasma glucose levels, plasma hemoglobin A1C, which is a measure of the average level of glucose in the bloodstream over the last 2 to 3 months. We have plasma insulin levels, a measure of insulin in the peripheral bloodstream. And then we also computed HOMA values, which is the homeostatic model assessment. And it basically is indexing beta cell function and insulin resistance. And it's computed using this formula here, using glucose levels and plasma levels, or plasma insulin levels. Here are the results of the diabetes indicators. So as far as glucose levels, there were no significant differences, nor were there any significant effects for the beta weight for the prenatal alcohol effect or the interaction between prenatal alcohol and body mass index. We also then looked at the percentage who met criteria for having elevated glucose levels. And that was high for 36-year-olds, but relatively comparable between groups. A1C, which is giving us more than just a point estimate in day, is sort of over the last 2 to 3 month period. Similarly, no significant differences in the overall beta weights or in the interaction between body mass index. But again, you can see here that about a quarter of the sample are showing risk. So I think it's really important when you do comparisons of prenatal alcohol exposure to make sure you're matching on some of those socioeconomic factors that are coming up. Where we did see significant differences, though, was things related to insulin. So our insulin levels were lower among those with prenatal alcohol exposure. And you see that in this beta weight here value, where we get a negative relationship associated with that beta weight. But you can see that that reverses, that effect reverses when we flip over and look at the prenatal alcohol exposure by body mass index interaction. So what it's saying is that there is an overall reduction in insulin until body mass index increases, and as body mass increases, you get a differential slope and a higher rate of insulin level associated with a body mass index increase. And the same thing was true of the HOMA value. So the exact same pattern of the relationship was similar to that of insulin. I don't think that's surprising, given that this is just a formula that's computed using the insulin and glucose levels. So I really think insulin levels are driving this relationship. This is a picture of the scatter plot of the insulin levels as they, you can see as they increase, and then also body mass index as it increases. And I've used this to index the point at which you cross over into a body mass index that's considered overweight using the CDC guidelines. The red dots are those who have prenatal alcohol exposure, and the blue ones are no prenatal alcohol exposure. You can see, again, there's significantly more individuals. There are only two individuals in that cohort who are not across that threshold of being overweight among the controls. So when we're referring to them, we're not necessarily referring to a sample that is typically developing in a group of individuals. They clearly are at risk because of their body mass index. But you can see the effect where they're this group that are have really low levels of insulin. And when you get to that threshold of being overweight, you see that dramatically increased slope for the prenatal alcohol exposed group versus those who's had no prenatal alcohol exposure. So at lower levels of prenatal alcohol or of BMI, insulin and insulin resistance was found to be lower in individuals with prenatal alcohol exposure, almost a protective effect. But at higher levels of body mass index, insulin and insulin resistant was found to be higher in individuals with prenatal alcohol exposure, such that the slope of the relationship between BMI and insulin levels was more positive. And so that could imply two things. One, it could be just a different effect. And the organs and the brain tissue involved in regulating insulin production are formulated very early on. It could be a differential effect of prenatal alcohol exposure on the pancreas or the liver or the pituitary gland. And so in one cluster of individuals, you're seeing this increased insulin sensitivity. And another group, you're seeing increased insulin resistance, and those are the ones whose body mass index increases more dramatically. You also might be seeing the same effect, but different stages of development of that effect. So there is a pattern of development of diabetes progression. So those with prenatal alcohol exposure might be causing an increased insulin sensitivity, meaning lower levels of insulin are getting the job done for you. But that can also contribute to having poor recognition of satiation and the lack of need for more caloric intake. So then you eat more and you become overweight, develop a higher level of allostatic load, and then cross over into insulin resistance. And that's a well-recognized pattern of diabetes development. So it's unclear whether the two different effects that we're seeing in the sample are a function of differential effect to different organs involved in insulin production, or whether or not it's an earlier precursor stage of the same condition. So one of the things that would be really helpful to help sort this out in the future would be to do challenge tests. So you can do an oral glucose tolerance test. We didn't do that in this study, but it would help sort out what the impact of increasing a bolus of glucose is on insulin levels to see whether the body is responding appropriately. And then also an insulin tolerance test where you increase insulin and look at the impact of glucose. So those would be two future assessments, I think, that would be really helpful to tease out some of these effects. The other thing I want to do is call attention to this group of very low levels of insulin. So there's a category called low insulin, meaning that you're clinically significantly low in your insulin level. There were no controls who were in that grouping. You had to have a level below 2.0 based on the standards from the laboratory in order to be categorized as low. There were five subjects in the PAE group who had that level. Here are their levels of their insulin. Their age levels all varied within the sample. There were no differences for male, female. It was kind of nothing stood out there as being significantly different. They were all positive for dysmorphia except for one. One only had alcohol-related neurodevelopmental damage. Neither were in a grouping of alcohol exposure with no effect. I looked at their other blood chemistries. So one individual down here, case number five, had an A1C that was 5.7. That's not huge, but it does indicate some risk for diabetes. And then among the others, there were no real risk factors for diabetes, indicating that the low levels of insulin don't appear to be related to the diabetes condition developing, at least at this time point. Their body mass index is here. Their blood pressure levels were here. One of them had an elevated level of blood pressure, but again, nothing dramatic here. What is dramatic though, is this effect of IQ. So we were able to go back into the data and look at their IQs that was obtained in the teen and adult years. For this one who looks like they might be pre-diabetic, they had IQs of 104 and 108. For the remaining four, their IQs are dramatically lower. So their IQs were 53 for case one, 54 and 54 for case two, 59 for 57 and 57 done in the teen years and adult years, and then the case four were both 55s. That's in the moderate or the low end of mild intellectual deficiency or the high end of moderate intellectual deficiency. That seemed to me to be pretty significant to be able to be flagging a group of individuals who had low insulin levels, atypically low insulin levels, and then had really significant cognitive impairment. I went back and looked through the data and developed a Z-score system for developmental assessments that were done at each of these age levels. So this was an average of values obtained on the Bayley Scales of Infant Development, the original one, because this was done a long time ago. And here are the scatter plots for each of these individuals in this group. And this is the controls, the prenatal alcohol exposure group, and then the PAE group with low insulin levels. Here they are in childhood, and at this point we're doing the Kaufman assessment battery for children, the KABC. It's its own unique, weird little test, but you can see the controls, the PAE group, and the PAE low insulin group. At adolescence, here's the distribution. This is with the standard WISC IQ, pretty infamous. The PAE group, and then you see the group with the PAE low insulin start to fall down. Here's that one individual who appears to be pre-diabetic, and then here's the same values in adulthood using the WASI, which is an abbreviated intelligence test. You see their IQs are being lower than the other two groups, and these four individuals are at the low end of the continuum of effective prenatal alcohol exposure, which really suggests to me there's been a hit to the system that has impacted not just insulin production, but that is a red flag for something that went on within the brain, in the central nervous system insulin. So this is just to show you the mean levels at each age group to show you that sort of relative decrement, because I think that this is also showing evidence that there is a differential decline for this group. So you can see the effect. This is an instrumentation effect for the no prenatal alcoholic group, a similar pattern for the PAE with no low insulin. And here's the mean values for this PAE with low insulin. And you see this differential decline at this time point from middle childhood to adolescence. I'm suggesting that whatever's going on here might actually not be a stable decline, but actually something going awry during subsequent development. So here's the graph showing the insulin levels and the WISC IQ. You can see just as there should be no relationship between insulin and the controls, but here this nice positive, maybe not nice, relationship between IQ levels and the alcohol exposed individuals. So insulin sensitivity has been associated with alterations in the pituitary gland. And I think that when we look at this data, it suggests that the CNS role in insulin signaling might have been impacted. You could have damage to a pituitary gland that would disrupt insulin signaling and produce insulin sensitivity or low levels of insulin that would then potentially also interfere with something called insulin-like growth factor. And so there are actually a lot of studies out there in the animal models and then even some in humans. So Ed, I know you're familiar with this study. It was done by Eileen Moore in 2016 showing posterior pituitary was altered in individuals diagnosed with FASD and also vasopressin, which stimulates gluconeogenesis in the liver, was found to be altered. And then also disruption in the anterior pituitary, which is involved in insulin-like growth factor, which impacts subsequent growth and development, may have been impacted in these individuals. I really think it's gonna be important to image some of these individuals and to look at the pituitary gland to see to what extent that's helping to produce some of these effects or not. We have some historical data from imaging. We don't actually have estimates of the pituitary gland and we haven't sampled the full sample that we have seen to date. So there are only about three of these individuals that were seen in the adult period and imaged. And so we've been trying to figure out if we can go back and try to reanalyze some of that to get an estimate of whether or not in these very vulnerable individuals, whether or not this has been impacted and is and what we're seeing in adulthood is an impact of disruption to this area of the brain that's heavily involved in insulin production and insulin growth factor signaling. So that's it. This is just a slide showing how complicated insulin and glucose are, but I'm not gonna go over that now.
If you're trying to talk, Ed, you're muted. I don't know if you are.
Well, I'm glad we have a few minutes for questions. So I found it really interesting. So I'll open it up if anyone has anything specific they'd like to ask. I could start. You have a group, obviously, in Atlanta with really lousy diets. All right. And I'm wondering if you looked at any nutritional, specific nutrients like vitamin D, that have known to impact insulin uptake and use.
You know, we don't. I regret that we did not do any sort of, I mean, this is an R21 and it would have been great to have a 3-day dietary intake and analyze different nutrient values and maybe even look at that. I think vitamin D is another one that can be an important factor in dealing with inflammation that's involved in glucose and insulin metabolism, so.
Yeah. And numerous years ago, probably at least 15, we treated animals with insulin-like growth factor.
I know, I saw that study.
Yeah, so it's, yeah, there's something there.
It is.
Well, whether it's, Ed, whether it's there for everybody or just a subset, so agreed. it could be that these are the most extreme that have had an impact to their pituitary, or it's the whole HPA axis, but the areas that I'm concerned about specifically are the areas that are involved in insulin regulation and signaling, and whether or not those individuals just happen to have a differential hit to that area of the brain that then is influencing the growth and development. For me, the part that is somewhat upsetting is that it's possible if it was insulin-like growth factor deficiency that could have been remedied. Yeah. Like we didn't know that then when these kids were 8 before they showed some evidence of further decline later down that road. But there actually have been randomized clinical studies of individuals who are SGA who don't have growth hormone deficits, and they give them insulin-like growth factor, and it facilitates growth and development. So I think it opens up a lot of interesting questions about the medical care and endocrine care. So, Miguel?
One other thing that's interesting is that our recruiter, who's familiar with all these people, can blind pick out who's going to have low insulin by their behavior.
Yeah, well, one of the things we were trying to clarify is, are these people starving to death? Was there a food insecurity issue? And so I went back to interview the recruiter about the participants. And so after I was done and she sort of told me a little bit about their lives for these five individuals, she said, well, why didn't you ask about, and she listed about four or five other names. And I wasn't sure at the time what she was picking on. But when I looked up their insulin levels, all of them were between 2 and 3. So they weren't in the clinically significantly low range, but they were right above that threshold. And when I asked her, she says, those are the most severely affected individuals in our sample. She's been working with us for so long, she has their IDs memorized, which totally blows my mind. But
Miguel?
Yeah, no, I have the feeling, and maybe it's what you said, but there was an abstract or a paper from Chile from many years ago.
Yes, 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 yes.
That proposed IGF-1 as a biomarker, low levels of IGF-1 as a biomarker for alcohol exposure.
Right, right. And IGF-1 and IGF-2.
Yes.
And I can't remember which one was lowest. So one of those was differentially lower at birth. And then subsequently, both IGF-2 and IGF-1 showed accelerated growth over time in the populations. And I think seeing those do that compensatory gain would be flagging those that are recovering function, and maybe the pituitary is not hit as hard. That would fit with Colin Carter's data, where he shows growth velocity differentially predicting success and developmental outcome. But also then those, a subset who maybe don't show that insulin growth factor recovery, they can't fix things because the pituitary is damaged so much. And those are the individuals who are going to have the most adverse outcomes.
Mm-hmm. Any other? Bill?
Hi, Julie. Nice presentation. I've got a question. Suzanne Delamonte, which many of you know, has worked on IGF signaling and FASD.
Yeah, yeah. I've read a lot of her work lately.
I'm recalling there was one paper, I think, that she tried to make a connection between abnormal IGF signaling and acetylcholine homeostasis and trying to make that link in the brain. I wonder if anyone's looked at acetylcholine levels. I'm not even sure what one would use to measure that, but as a potential link between what's going on and the cognitive issues you see in your subset.
Yeah, no, I've read her papers. She makes a great case, and there are actually a great deal of animal model data in this area. There's a good review done by Karen Moritz's Lisa Atkinson, that group, that review all the animal model literature. I think they only hit one or two of the human studies, and there are a couple of studies out there in the human literature that they missed. But, I agree. There's a level, I kind of stop at the receptor level, trying to understand this, to be honest, as a pediatric psychologist, when they start jumping in below the receptor level, that's when I find my brain getting exhausted in trying to understand that. And I'm perfectly willing to leave that part of it to the animal model people. So I think those would be interesting questions, because there are a variety of sort of protein and molecular things that are happening that need a lot of work modeling this out to understand what's going on.
Well, John's still on the phone, and John and I think it was with John, we did some work on choline type of drugs, acetylcholine, isostigmine. We always got an effect. We could never predict which way it was going to go. And it may be those variability now in this subgroup of people or subgroup that gets affected. But that was always a strange thing. It was just, you get an effect, but you couldn't predict how it was going to happen. So, but that was 30 years ago, John.
Yes, it was. 33.
So, well, I want to thank both Olivia and Julie for presenting today. I've really enjoyed these last couple calls that we've had where we've had these themes. I think I've learned a lot and seen a lot, and I really appreciate it. And I like the input from everybody. So unless there's, I know people have other conference calls, unless there's pressing business. Thank you very much and have a good day. Stay safe. And maybe Bill and Joe and Michael could stay on for 2 minutes, if that's possible. All right, everybody. Thank you.
Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I'll come here, you. I can't get off because I can't use my hand. I'm going now.
We're going to talk.
I have a broken hand. It's hard for me to manipulate the mouse.
So do you think we should continue, Claire, or not? So what I wanted to ask is the SAB report, I sent it out. I'm sorry it was late. I thought I had gotten it to you and Joe earlier. Is it okay if I